Marta, are we co-editors? Like, I'm trying to figure out the titles.
We're both.
That's what it should be, Marta. That's the role that you serve.
Executive editor Nick Kraskel.
Isn't that the Alexander Haig moment? Is that like when you step in?
I'm in charge.
Oh, I love that you referenced Alexander Haig. I doubt the two youngsters even know who that is or what that's about.
No, I'm looking it up.
This is Behind the Lens, a podcast from The Lens, New Orleans' first nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest newsroom dedicated to unique investigative and explanatory journalism. I'm Carolyn Heldman. On this week's episode, the Louisiana Public Records Act, also known as Louisiana's Sunshine Law, was enacted by the state's legislature in 1952, assuring transparency and disclosure in government and business. At The Lens, we're celebrating Sunshine Week, highlighting the importance of this law and our ability to fulfill our mission. We'll take a look back at a few of the most important stories we were able to report on because of this law and preview a public event we have coming up. Joining us this week, criminal justice reporter Nick Kraskel. Hey, Nick.
Hey, Carolyn.
Co-editor and education reporter Marta Jusen. Hey, Marta.
Hi, Carolyn.
And co-editor Katie Rechdahl. Katie, we're going to start this week with you. Let's go back a few years for our first story. Tell us about Henry Montgomery.
So Henry Montgomery was a guy who was arrested for murder of a police officer when he was 17 years old. And when all of the Supreme Court decisions were coming down about juveniles and whether they should be able to be held with life without parole, Henry Montgomery's case came up. And he's now, I'm trying to think of how old he must be now. I think he's like 77 now. October 2015 is when I first filed the story. And I was doing footwork. So this was in October when I filed the story. I was doing footwork that summer, a lot of footwork on this story. I went to Henry Montgomery's old neighborhood. I drove around. I saw where the scene of the crime was. And I was looking at some old records, just talking about that there was this widespread manhunt that had happened right after the shooting, because it was a cop, you know. Deputies from all across the state drove into Baton Rouge and were stopping every young Black man they could find. And actually not just young Black man, every Black man.
Right.
Like, it was unbelievable, right? So I was trying to see if I could find those records. And I know in the New Orleans Public Library, I've looked through old books that you can find. But I called the Baton Rouge Public Library and they didn't have anything like it. So I called the sheriff's office in East Baton Rouge, and I made a request. I talked to a deputy and I made a request for the original booking records of Henry Montgomery, right? Now, keep in mind that he was picked up in 1963, mm-hmm. right? So those records are old. So I had to call back and call back. And finally, I got somebody who was interested in it, a deputy who seemed interested in it. And he said, man, I think that stuff is in a warehouse in Baker, Louisiana. And he was going to go check it and he'd see if he could find it. And then he called me. And so this is the Sunshine Law that got me in the door,
yep.
right?
Yep.
Because I could actually ask for something like this. But what really got me to where I needed to go was this deputy who actually was interested in what I was reporting on, which is another part of our reporting, right? Is if you have somebody who actually cares about the subject, you can get farther, right?
Because let me interrupt you right there. It is the Sunshine Law allows it means that when requested, they must provide these records. But in this case, for example, you know, these records were from now, what, 40, 50 years ago. And, right, is that the right math? Yeah. 50 years ago. And they're off in some warehouse somewhere. Is that on them? They have to provide the labor. They have to then, you know, somebody has to go get it because you're asking. And if you don't, I guess we'll get into this when we talk about what we're going to explain at the public event. But is the recourse to sue and say you must get these for us, or can't they just say they don't exist?
The short answer to that is that any public agency has to provide you records in their possession. So in that case, someone has to go and segregate the records and allow you to examine them either at that warehouse or maybe at their office.
Okay.
But they can charge money for the staff time that it takes for that to happen.
Okay.
So really what happens is it depends on how willing the agency is to follow the law, essentially. But then sometimes you can end up in a courtroom, as the Lens has done before.
Right. So, Katie, go back. You found a friend. You got somebody who was interested, a friendly person at the sheriff's department who actually was interested in this, too. So he did the legwork that he was required to do by law. Yeah. But
right. But often, I mean, it took some time, but when he came back, he was so pleased that he had this big book. And I remember driving there, and he just put me in a room with a book, and I took pictures of it. And I just couldn't even believe that it, for every name, it just said investigation. It didn't say anything else. That was, they kept them. At least for a night. Some were kept quite a bit longer. There was one person I interviewed for this story who ended up having to drop out of Southern because he was held so long. And so it was really that old book with all of its lines in it was the start of the story, really, for me. And I was making phone calls like crazy. That it had the names and the addresses from 52 years of people who had left, right? But sometimes I was able to find somebody, like if they kept that family home for a long time. And so I did. I ended up finding, I don't know how many people, probably about a dozen people who were within those people who had been stopped. And they described the manhunt. You know, the manhunt was described. I ended up finding a clip in the paper, in the Baton Rouge paper, about how they kept people overnight and fed them peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. But it didn't say anything about the manhunt from the standpoint of being a young Black man in that neighborhood. And these people told that story, and that came from that book. You know, that came from that book. And the person who we went there and took lots of pictures. The lawyer for this case was in his 90s. He's not passed, but he was still around. And he talked to me for the story as well. The doors just opened up once we had this book. One of the guys described them being taken to the sheriff's office in a paddy wagon with 30 people in it. And he said we were sitting three high, one on top of each other. The recollections were really vivid despite all the time that had passed. So I don't know, you know, people talked about how they were fired from their little dishwashing jobs, or they don't know why they were listed as a material witness because they knew nothing about what had happened. This one guy, Wilbert Forrest, who was in Southern University, was taken in custody the same day as Montgomery. And I found him through this book. You know, I found him through this book. He was held more than 2 weeks. And was he ended up being transferred to a different jail for, they said, shooting at cows. That all was dropped, but he ended up withdrawing from school because he'd missed too much time.
So you come up on this requesting through the Sunshine Act, and you were lucky in this case, I guess, to have been find a person who was receptive and who was willing to play along. Does that happen more often than not, or is the reverse true?
I mean, it was such a blessing to have this book, but it's so unusual. This is like, I probably will never have this again in my life, if I can be honest. Like, usually you have to fight tooth and nail to get every public records request, or most of them.
I want to talk about the sort of antagonistic nature of journalists versus government here.
I think we can have that conversation anytime. It might be a good segue to You know, I think it is. I learned probably from being a little contrarian when I first started this job, because I was basically monitoring public meetings and kind of always in there with the laser focused mindset that, you know, being nice and being a human is a lot easier way to start getting records than kind of coming in so formally every time. But sometimes you also have to come in formally because you want to set those dates into motion. So I think sometimes there might be a little bit of an initial reaction from public agencies when you're coming in. They want to know what you're looking for. They want to know why you're looking for it.
Mm-hmm.
They're also not allowed to ask you that. So that's something we'll teach you in the seminar. Mm-hmm. They can only ask you for your age and for you to verify how old you are. Why children can't request records, I don't understand. I think high schoolers should be able to do that, but that's a tangent on its own.
Okay.
But I think there is kind of a potentially a sense of, I don't know if it's invasion or what, but one example I'll give you is in the last couple of weeks, I asked a charter school for a bunch of property records related to taxes they're paying and some other stuff. And they didn't want to give me the records physically. So they were like, why don't you come in and review them? And I was like, okay, that's fine. I'll come in next week, which is something they're allowed to do. Otherwise they can charge you for copies. And, you know, the Lens is a little nonprofit, so we try not to pay for stuff we don't have to pay for. And then they came back today and were like, actually, we just emailed them all to you. And I was like, oh, you just don't want me sitting in your school for 4 hours. So, you know, I think it's hard to negotiate and massage those relationships because it just depends on the agency and what you're asking for.
Right, right. Well, let's use that as a segue into your story, Marta, because you broke a story, a pretty sensational story about Kennedy High School. And this wasn't that long ago. It was just a few summers ago, 2019. Remind us about that story.
Yeah, so that was a... kind of like Katie's, you know, these stories start with people. And in this case, it started with the tipster who came to us and said, hey, the network, charter network I've been working for started to change grades for students. They changed their grades from F to D's and D's to C's so that they would pass, so that they'd have a higher graduation rate, and just kind of higher metrics overall. So then their state school score, that A through F letter grade would, in the end, you know, ideally be it. A little bit higher. And so kind of this, like, you know, very subtle manipulation across students, across grades, across quarters could really add up. And when he brought those grade books to us, so he had the records. And I think that's, you know, kind of like Katie was talking about, the deputy who was ready to help. When you have someone on the inside who has those records already, can preserve them. And then, you know, the other important thing about records requests is like knowing exactly what to ask for can be really helpful. So if you know the title of a document, or, you know, the name of a software or a column in a spreadsheet, that's really going to help you zero in. So in this case, Rennell King brings us a grade book and it shows a digital copy of a grade book. It shows, you know, that these grades have been manually manipulated. They've been changed. And when we bring that to the administration, they first deny it. And then eventually it really, really, really just snowballed. They hired a contracting company, 10 Square, that audited the grades that showed they had been changed. It showed, but they found other things had been changed. And then I'd say where we really got into it with the public records was we requested all the emails between administrators in those months. And that showed it was just like absolute chaos. Once the accusation was made and then up, you know, up until the day of and after graduation where there's people are typing in all caps, we can't give out diplomas tomorrow. Like we don't know who's eligible and who's not. It's just a mess.
Yeah. I remember that story very well. And you said it started basically with a whistleblower.
Yes. And Rennell King. Yep. He openly talked to us and is reporting, and has been a vocal critic. I mean, and then he no longer worked for that organization. And I think something Katie will also acknowledge is that people in the charter system who speak up have frequently essentially been blackballed, right? Like they're blacklisted, like their other networks don't want to hire them. They don't have union protection. So he ended up working in a different city.
No, I do feel like that's happened every once in a while when you get somebody who talks to you that suddenly they're, especially in the school system. But you know what? I feel like it's happened in city government too. I had a really good whistleblower in Kimberly Williamson Butler's clerkship when she was clerk of court. She was kind of, did she have to resign? It wasn't a great run anyway. And there were a bunch of records. I had tons of people telling me what records to ask for. And that the person who was my best source in there was sort of shoved to the side in the end. Although I have to say, one of the moments that was most, we went to court for that. It was a whole day long hearing. And there was a book that had money going to the bank that was, there was some question about that, some of that stuff. And there was a courier who would make those errands, and she wouldn't hand over that book. She said it didn't exist. Hmm. And the courier, as it turned out, was like a civil rights guy who said he showed up to court and testified for us, and he kept his job. I never understood how that happened. But he said, yeah, it's a red book or whatever. Like, he described it. Isn't that amazing? Marta, that story, though, and that person who came to you, he's a teacher, right?
He was a teacher who was then, like, a data manager when this happened.
It just felt like he created a whole layer of checks and balances that at least sort of protected this from happening again, right?
Yeah, and in theory, like, that kicked off, unfortunately, kind of at the sacrifice of that class of students who then had to make up classes and grades and all this stuff. And it was no fault of their own. It was both adults at that school and adults throughout the system, and a bifurcated system that didn't communicate with each other. So they had seniors who were ninth graders at a different school, and they didn't know what classes they had taken. But that did set into motion. The district put in another set of checks and balances for high schools and high school transcripts.
Right.
And, you know, this happens all over the place. I had a friend call and say it was happening in district she works in out of state. And I was like, okay, well, I know people in the media in that state. You want me to tell anybody? And she was like, I don't know. Like, does it hinder the kid more to not graduate
right
on time if they just miss this one little thing or if something weird happened? Or are they really lacking on their education? And I mean, obviously the answer is to do it right from the start.
Yeah, it's tough stuff. Thanks, Marta.
Thank you.
You're listening to Behind the Lens, a podcast from The Lens, New Orleans' first nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest newsroom. I'm Carolyn Heldman. My guests this week are criminal justice reporter Nick Krastel, education reporter and co-editor Marta Jusen, and co-editor Katie Rechdahl. Join us for a public records workshop next Thursday at 6 p.m., where we'll explain what can be learned from government records, why you're entitled to see them, and how to get them. The event is free and open to the public, with a suggested donation of $10 to support our mission. Learn more about the workshop and how to register at thelensnola.org.
Hi, I'm Ann Muller, Chief Operating Officer at The Lens. The Lens aims to engage and empower the residents of New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. If you'd like the inside scoop on what stories we're pursuing, what events and initiatives are coming up, and to learn more about the people who report at The Lens, subscribe today to our newsletter at thelensnola.org/newsletters. Thank you.
Nick, you broke a story in the summer of 2022 about kids being shipped across state lines to juvenile detention facilities in violation of Louisiana law. That was just, you know, that was yesterday. Remind us of what happened.
Yeah, so I sort of heard at a state legislative hearing, a district attorney offhandedly mention that his district was paying, you know, upwards of $600 to house juveniles in a facility in Alabama. And this is something I had never heard of before, and was pretty surprising. You know, these are kids that were being arrested in Louisiana and being sent to another state for detention. So I started to try and look into it and you know, was calling around to people who might know something about this, including, you know, juvenile defense attorneys in these across the state, and kind of figuring out what municipalities might be doing this. And people were really hesitant to talk, partly, I think, because these kids all had pending cases, and there was a hesitancy among attorneys to kind of, one, you know, these are kids, so they're very hesitant to talk about specific cases, but also to be critical of of the people who are prosecuting these cases.
Mm-hmm.
So to kind of try and find out more, I got some tips about where these kids might be going and what parishes might be sending them there, and started filing public records requests, which eventually kind of led to this story that showed, you know, there were over a dozen parishes and cities sending kids out of state, and it potentially violated state law.
How did they justify it at the time? I think part of it was just facility size and not having enough room, but what else? I forget.
Yeah, that's basically it. I mean, to be fair, the agencies that were doing it were not happy about it. They basically said, we don't have enough juvenile detention space in our, you know, cities, and even in the state, the other facilities throughout the state are all full. So this is kind of our only option. And, you know, we don't like having to spend this amount of money to do this. And we don't like having to use our office resources to drive these kids there. But obviously, it was also a big problem for, you know, juvenile rights advocates, because these kids are hours away from their families, they're hours away from their attorneys, and they haven't even yet been convicted of anything.
Right.
So it's really the opposite of what kind of best practices across the country state about juvenile detention, and they really should be, you know, as close to their communities as possible, and be detained for the most limited, you know, amount of time possible. So,
right. Will you remind me, Nick, did any of the correspondence or whatever you were able to obtain through the Open Records Act, did it show that they were aware that this was against their own state's laws to do this, and they were just desperate?
No. And, you know, there's an argument that it's against state law, but it's never been found by any courts to be in violation. And it I think it's likely still going on. So it has been challenged once, but the Louisiana Supreme Court denied to hear it. So it's kind of this open question that the court system has, declined to directly address. And what we got were mostly invoices and contracts between the agencies. So nothing that really showed that it was legal. I did have some conversations with local officials who basically said, no, like we weren't aware this is illegal. We are doing this because it's necessary, and no one's told us we can't, basically.
That's fascinating. So even to the extent that an organization, a government department is violating its own laws, but if a court in the state refuses or turns a blind eye to it, it can just keep on keeping on.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, just to be clear, the argument from people who would say that this practice is illegal is because juvenile detention centers in the state of Louisiana need to be licensed by the Department of Children and Family Services. That's a licensing requirement. The law does not specifically say kids cannot be transferred out of state, but these out-of-state facilities are not licensed by the state DCFS. So, you know, I think reading the law pretty clearly intends for anywhere that a Louisiana child is going to be held to be licensed by
a state.
Yeah, the state, and that's not happening in these cases. You know, the argument is that there's really no oversight into the, you know, state, local oversight into the conditions at these facilities, no recourse to sort of challenge them if they may be problematic. But like I say, it's not some extremely clear provision like you can't do this. It's, kind of the reading of our licensing standards that would lead you to come to that conclusion, which I think is a reasonable one.
Right. And they may be saying that this is just splitting hairs to say it's not licensed by the Louisiana Department of Child Services. But what it would require is, you know, real advocates on behalf of the kids, which it had. But then once the Supreme Court in Louisiana says they're not going to hear the case, it's over. It's effectively over.
Right. Yeah, I think that's accurate.
All right. So how did that process go for you requesting those records? Did you come up against any pushback?
I was just going back and trying to figure it out because it was a while ago. But I think one of the most difficult things was sort of identifying the localities. I mean, criminal justice system is such a patchwork in Louisiana. You know, you have city police departments and city jails. You have parish sheriff's departments. And trying to figure out exactly where those contracts were. I think actually, ultimately, a number of the records I got came from the Mississippi Juvenile Detention Center and talking to a judge there who kind of coordinated the contracts. And they sent me a list of the parishes that they were contracting with. And I mean, this kind of goes to Marta's point. It can be really hard. And then, like, sometimes it's really easy. You talk to the right person and you have the information, like, you know, a few hours, and it's incredible. When, or you file a request and follow up 10 times and, you know, 6 months later, you still don't have, you know, some records that you feel like should be relatively straightforward to get. So,
also, I want to highlight Nick's strategy there, because I think this is a tip we can pass along to a lot of people, which is you ask multiple agencies for the same records, right? Because in this case, Louisiana would have a more vested interest likely in protecting those records. Maybe they're going to end up stalling or take longer. Mississippi, on the other hand, you know, they're kind of just on the receiving end. They're not violating Louisiana state laws that
right.
we can tell. So I do that all the time. I ask for records from a charter, from the district, from the state, and some agencies are better than others at responding.
Yeah, and it's also a good way, I mean, to make sure you have everything. You know, if one agency gives you more than the other one, then you know, obviously.
There's more to be had.
And that can be just a kind of general challenge with public records, is you kind of are, you know, have to trust that the agency is giving you everything they have. But one sort of check you have is if you ask multiple agencies for the same stuff.
So next Thursday, we're hosting an event. We do these from time to time. It's sort of a seminar on how to request open records, why they're important, and what the process is to do it. It's obviously really critical work for our job, your job as reporters, to get these stories. How does requesting open records help a general member of the public? What are the different ways that it could be helpful?
So I think at these seminars, we just try to paint a basic picture of what rights you're afforded as a Louisiana citizen, right? Or you are able to request public records. If you're over the age of 18, they have to be provided within 3 days, or you have to be given a timeline. And I think what's really important is there are a lot of records in the education space and criminal justice space and environmental space, which we're going to have three different seminars about each of them. That are available to the public, educational records for your child or what they have rights to certain services are something you can often get the ball rolling when you start asking for these official documents that you may not know you're entitled to. And when it comes to the criminal justice system, I'll let Nick or Katie talk about that. But those are documents that are really important, you know, to your cases. And then if people are not able to communicate from the inside or something, well, we want their family members to know what they would have access to.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of people in this city are either have some relation to the criminal legal system or know someone who does. And it can be a hard thing to navigate, and it can be confusing. And knowing kind of what documents you're able to get, what information public agencies are required to give you, can really, you know, be illuminating and can give you a little bit of your own agency when kind of trying to navigate these things. So I think that, you know, hopefully would be helpful to people. And then, you know, there's another layer of just kind of trying to understand from a citizen's point of view how our, you know, criminal justice system actors are going about the business. What are the police doing? Where are they responding to calls? You know, if you see something going on in your neighborhood, how can you find out more about, you know, any particular incident? So things like that, I think, are, you know, hopefully useful to people just kind of going about their day-to-day business as citizens of the city.
we're lucky to be able to, you know, this is our job, right? So we get paid to pursue public records, but for anyone in the public whose job this isn't, that's a lot of extra work for you. So we want you to know what rights you have, what if roadblocks are thrown up, what they're allowed to do or charge you for, or, you know, what they're not allowed to do. I have a parent at a school right now who's requested records, and they just told her she has to fill out a specific form to request them. And that's not true. You don't have to fill out a specific form to request them. So they're just, you know, they can kind of put up these little tiny roadblocks, and, you know, we want to help you know what they can and can't do when it comes to that.
Mm-hmm.
Help you jump those hurdles.
Yeah. And I think we'll probably get into some of the public facing databases that, you know, don't require filing specific requests, but how you can kind of gather information just through kind of the already available stuff online and database and dashboards and things like that. So
we're going to have a special guest. We're going to have Everett Buff Offre, who works in the Orleans Public Defenders now, but he was an inmate counsel at the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola for a while. When he was held there, he was good at his job. And one of the hardest parts of being in the gears of the criminal justice system is that you are trying to get records to deal with your sentence often. And that is can be really, really difficult. So he's an expert of a different kind of a different level. Like, he is doing this because people's lives depend on it, right?
Katie, can I have you finish with a little bit of the high-minded stuff about journalists and as a watchdog and how important it is to hold power to account and to keep government transparent?
I mean, I've seen a public record that had everything blacked out except for six words that exonerated Dan Bright, right? I've seen a public record that came from the microfiche that showed that John Thompson's blood was not the blood that was on the victim's pants.
Mm.
It is an unbelievable thing to see. I mean, it's an unbelievable process to see public records that actually change people's lives and vindicate people who were wrongly convicted, convict people who need to be convicted, all of that. This all happens with public records. And so it can be so powerful to see it at work.
And it's your job to get it. So we are grateful for all the work you guys do. Thank you. Okay, I hope everyone can join us next Thursday. I'm gonna let you all go.
Thanks, Carolyn.
Yeah.
This is Behind the Lens, a podcast from The Lens, New Orleans' first nonprofit, nonpartisan public interest newsroom. I'm Carolyn Heldman. Thanks to our guest this week, criminal justice reporter Nick Krastel, co-editor and education reporter Marta Jusen, and co-editor Katie Rechtal. The Lens aims to provide the information and analysis necessary to advocate for more accountable and just governance. Join us for a public records workshop next Thursday at 6 p.m., where we will explain what can be learned from government records, why you're entitled to see them, and how to get them. The event is free and open to the public, with a suggested donation of $10 to support our important mission. Learn more about the workshop and how to register at thelensnola.org. Thanks for listening.